This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Jazz musician Steve Lacy, considered by many to be the best soprano saxophone player of his era, died earlier this month. He was 69. Lacy was born in the Upper West Side of New York City as Stephen Lakritz. He studied clarinet originally, but switched to soprano saxophone after hearing Sidney Bechet on a 1941 recording of a Duke Ellington song, The Mooch. His work on soprano sax would later inspire John Coltrane to pick up the instrument. Steve Lacy apprenticed with jazz traditionalists like Pee Wee Russell and Hot Lip Page. But early in his career, he also found a home in modern jazz and the avant-garde, playing with Thelonious Monk and Cecil Taylor. He moved to Europe in the mid-60s, living mainly in Paris. 2 years ago, Lacy moved back to the U.S. and started teaching at the New England Conservatory of Music. He died in Boston of cancer. Terry spoke with Steve Lacy in 1997. Before we hear their conversation, let's listen to a 1961 recording of Thelonious Monk's Who Knows, with Steve Lacy on soprano saxophone and Don Cherry on trumpet.
You've said that certain parts of the soprano's range are inherently out of tune with the rest of the horn. What part of the range is that, and why is that so?
Well, there are notes here that are too flat and others that are too sharp. It's a little bit, maybe because it's conical rather than cylindrical. And it's sort of a bastard instrument in a way that it needs to be doctored personally. You have to really... favor certain, but I mean, this is true of a lot of instruments, really. Alto also has funny regions that you have to favor, that you have to, push up, push down, and compensate for the inherent difficulties in the instrument itself.
Does this mean that you need to have a really good ear for pitch in order to play the soprano? And did you have to work hard to develop your ear?
You have to suffer, or I had to suffer really some really hard periods where it was really out of tune, where I just couldn't fix it, really. This was years and years ago, in the 50s, when I was struggling with the instrument. It was very difficult at that time to get it in tune. And now, after all these years, it's much easier, but I have to watch it all the time.
Now, the soprano has a naturally nasal and shrill sound in its highest notes. Is that something that you feel like you fight against or try to exploit?
It doesn't have that at all, really. It doesn't need to have that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just poor playing, you know. Even John Coltrane, when he first played the instrument, he had trouble up there, and it came out nasal and all that. But after a while... it opened up. It's just like your nose, really. If you breathe through your nose, it's all about breathing, really, and it's also about conception. And when you have experience of the horn, it opens up, and it doesn't have to be nasal there at all. But that's one of the reasons I don't play the other saxophones, because I really want to just be faithful to that one, really.
A few years ago, you did... what kind of exercise book with a series of short essays? That elaborated some of your thinking about studying the instrument.
Yeah.
You have one exercise you call the No Baby exercise. Would you explain that for us?
Well, that comes from a piece that I wrote a long time ago. It was originally intended as a portrait of Sidney Bechet, who I imagined was talking to his girlfriend, and he was saying, "No, baby. no, baby, no, baby, no, baby, like that. And that's how that piece began, really. And then I wrote a melody to go with that, which was a sort of a blues in unusual harmonies. And we played that for years and years and recorded and everything. And the idea of the exercise coming from that is the dynamics, the way of saying something each time louder, and the way of corresponding your saxophone to your own speech.
So, in other words, learning the things we already intuitively
language.
Know about speech
about
and
language.
Applying that to the instrument.
It's about language. My fundamental thing is about language, really. I deal with language. Mm-hmm. The jazz is language. The saxophone is language. And a lot of the music I write is based on literature and texts and language.
You recommend trying to sing and play whatever you hear.
Yeah.
Do you sing a lot as part of your exercise?
Well, yeah, that's very important. The connection with the voice, the ear, and the saxophone is fundamental. Is something I learned in Japan, actually, from a Zen master, a flute player, who gave me a couple of lessons. And that was the first lesson he gave me, was the connection with the ear, the voice, and the instrument, and the breath. And that was a huge revelation for me.
What was the connection that he made clear that you hadn't thought of before?
That my own voice was my own ear, was my own breath, was my own sound, that it was all one. That in the conception that it is, it's just one thing. It's got to be like one thing.
What was your role in inspiring John Coltrane to try soprano saxophone?
Well, I was sort of the model. In other words, he heard me play it, and he thought it was like he was shopping, and I was modeling. So he heard me with, I was playing with Jimmy Giuffre at the Five Spot, and he came in and he heard me play, and he was intrigued by the instrument, and he asked me what key it was in, and when I told him it was B-flat, he said, oh, yeah? And then a couple of weeks later, Don Cherry called me from Chicago, and he said, listen to this, and he held the telephone up, and I could hear Train playing the soprano.
What did you think of what you first heard of his?
Well, I had a laugh, really. But, I thought, wow, it's nice to have some company.
You're not saying what you thought of the playing.
It sounded intriguing to me. I liked it, really. It sounded good. I mean, you know, if Don Cherry calls you up and said, listen to this, it's probably going to be good.
Steve Lacy, who else was playing soprano when you started to play in the 50s?
Nobody, really. It was in complete disuse. It had gone out of phase. Like the musicians had considered it. People played it in the 20s and the 30s, and it went by the 40s. I mean, even Johnny Hodges stopped in 1942. And it, from that point on, it disappeared because it had a reputation for being out of tune, and arrangers didn't know what to do with it, and it just fell into disuse. So I think the only person that I knew of playing it was a student of Bechet's, who was Bob Wilbur, and he was playing exactly like Bechet, really, and that's all. And nobody else was playing it.
What were the pros and cons of feeling like you had the field to yourself?
Well, the advantages were many. I didn't compete with anybody. I didn't threaten anybody else's job, so that I was welcomed into all these traditional bands that I played with. My teacher, Cecil Scott, took me around and had me sit in with the likes of Red Allen, Pee Wee Russell, and all these people. And after a while, I started getting hired and working with all these original masters, who were at the peak of their form, really. They were in their 50s and 60s. I was 19, 20. And that's how I cut my teeth, really. I learned from playing with these people. And it was the New Orleans school and the Chicago school and the Kansas City school.
And the disadvantages?
And the disadvantages were that nobody hired me after a while.
Because they didn't know what to do with you?
Well, the traditional, I stopped playing the clarinet. See, I was working with Max Kaminsky regularly, and I was playing soprano and clarinet, and it was working very well. And I decided to concentrate only on the soprano at that point, because I think I was starting to play with Cecil Taylor also. And when I told Max I'm not going to play the clarinet anymore, he said, "You're crazy. You won't get any work at all." And it was true. Those people, I stopped working with them, and I started to play with Cecil Taylor.
Let me play something that was part of your recording debut. This was made, I think it was 1954, when you were, I believe, 20 years old, in a kind of traditional jazz group led by Dick Sutton.
Mm-hmm.
And you played both clarinet and soprano in this. We'll hear you on soprano on a recording of Liza. You want to say anything about this session before we hear it?
Well, that was a young band. They called it Progressive Dixieland. It was Dick Sutton's conception, and it was influenced by Mulligan and by Bix Beiderbecke and Miles, and it was like a hybrid movement. It had some freshness to it. It was good.
An interesting concept and interesting music as well. So this is Liza with my guest Steve Lacy on soprano saxophone, recorded in 1954, his recording debut.
Back with more of soprano saxophonist and composer Steve Lacy. A couple of years after playing modern Dixieland in the mid-50s, Steve Lacy joined a group led by avant-gardist Cecil Taylor. Terry Gross asked Lacy about that shift in his direction.
Well, yeah, it was a radical change, that's for sure. But Cecil had very strong traditional roots also, and we both had a shared interest in the Ellington line, and that's like a line that covers a lot of ground, really, and goes through. See, I was playing with Don Fry at Jimmy Ryan's when I met Cecil, and that was like the Ellington, James P. Johnson line, all that. That's traditional. And Cecil also comes from like Duke Ellington and Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell, and this is another tradition, but in a way they're the same. It's the same story. It's just one ocean of jazz, really, with a lot of different strains to it.
Cecil Taylor took you to hear Thelonious Monk, and that, I think, really changed your music, too. When you heard Monk and became very excited by his harmonies and his rhythms, his odd rhythms, I'm wondering how you translated some of that to soprano. For example, a lot of Monk's music is based on these really unusual, interesting harmonies, very often dissonant harmonies, and you're playing a single line instrument.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't make chords on a soprano saxophone. So how did you, is there a way you feel you were able to apply some of his harmonic thinking into your horn?
Well, first of all, I play the piano as a laboratory, and I learned all his tunes at the piano, really, with the, you know, with the chords and everything, with the sounds, with the intervals and the voicings as much as I could. And then working on my horn, you can't play a chord all at once, but you can delineate it, you can outline it, you can express it. There is a way to express everything on everything, if you can find it. It's a question of imagination.
Monk invited you to join his quartet, making the group a quintet for the 4 months that you were there. Do you have any idea why he asked you to join? I mean, obviously he liked what you were doing.
He was familiar with me. He knew me and all that, and he knew I was really not an expert, but an aficionado of his music, and maybe he thought I needed the experience. That's what I like to think. I like to think that he gave me that opportunity to really see what was happening from the inside.
You've been recording Monk compositions throughout your career, and I want to play one of the duets from a recent album called Five Facings, and it's a series of duets with five different other jazz musicians. And I want to play one of the duets that you recorded with Misha Mengelberg, a Dutch pianist who's also very influenced by Monk. Let's hear your recording of Monk's Off Minor, a duet with the Dutch pianist Misha Mengelberg. And this was recorded in 1996. It seems to me on this, it's as if you on the soprano saxophone are playing the right hand and Misha Mengelberg on piano is playing the left hand.
Well, that's, in a way, I mean, I am a melodic instrument. All I can do is a single line of melody, and Misha has all the harmonic equipment down there, the armaments. He's armed to the teeth, really. He could do all that stuff, but he's got the taste and the discretion and the knowledge of Monk to complement what I do, and we always hit it off well together.
Okay, well, this is Off Minor. And what did you learn seeing the music from the inside? What are some things you got from actually playing with Monk and talking with him?
I learned to stick to the point and to not lose the point and not get carried away, and to play with the other musicians and not to get all wrapped up in my own thing, and not to just play interesting notes just to be interesting, you know, or weird notes just to be weird. He mostly told me what not to do. He never told me what to do, but he told me what not to do when I did something that bothered him. For example, when I played, when we were playing together, sometimes he would play something on the piano and I would pick that up and play that on my horn. I thought I was being slick, you know, and he stopped me. He said, "Don't do that. That's, you know, I'm the piano player. You play your part. I'm accompanying you. Don't pick up on my things." You know, he got me out of the thing of trying to be too hip. I was trying to be too hip, and it wasn't swinging sometimes, you know. then he told me, make the drummer sound good. Because I was playing some things that confused the drummer, because I was confused myself. And so the drummer was not swinging, you know, and Monk told me, no, make the drummer sound good. And that was an enormous help to me, really. It stopped me cold, really, and changed my focus. And Monk's thing, he told me, let things go by. Let certain things go by. Don't play everything. Just play certain things. Let other things go by. It's what you don't play that's very important, really, and that's extremely important.
A kind of intervals of laying out of the
space.
Yeah.
Space, using the space as time,
mm-hmm.
and using time and digging time as space.
Steve Lacy, speaking to Terry Gross in 1997. He died earlier this month at age 69.